You've just landed inside Launch Street, the innovation podcast, where we interview top innovators out there shaking things up so you can innovate and differentiate
and get further faster in this crazy cluttered world.
And now, innovation thought leader
and your super fly host,
Tamara Kleinberg.
What's up, Launch Street? Tamara here, your host and the person that has a serious love-hate with the morning hours. I love the early hours and I love getting out of bed and I love the morning, but man, when that alarm clock goes off at 4 a.m., it always surprises me. Like it never happened the day before. I don't know. Love, hate. Okay. Do you know what's hard? Change. So in this episode, I interview Gabe Shaolin, digital marketing and business development expert who started an agency as a one-man show and grew it to a mid-sized global digital agency with over 250 full-time employees. He works with clients big and small that are trying to manage through change, so I thought he'd be a great person to talk to. And he was. We dug in. We talk about how the hardest part about innovation and change is breaking old habits to create new ones. Now, I know that all sounds kind of intuitive, but he's got a little bit of a different take to it that I think is important. How it takes more than just change itself, but constant reinforcement. That reinforcement, in fact, should become part of your routine. And we also dig into how sometimes you need to break away from the day-to-day just to get out of the weeds and see the bigger picture. And also, he shares a pretty vulnerable story about how badly it sucks when your customers tell you they don't like what you're hawking. All right, let's dig in. Gabe, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so what's the one thing people would be surprised to learn about you?
I'll share something very secret with you. And I think that I am very, sometimes, even though some people might say I'm successful because I built a company, over 200 employees, I sold that company, and people would say, hey, that's a great achievement. I still sometimes feel like I haven't achieved or been successful yet. And I'm always paranoid that if I'm going to fail.
Yeah. So I appreciate that you share that because I think most of us, it's the truth and have a hard time admitting it. Let me ask you this. Is that I haven't achieved enough yet? Are you looking at certain people or businesses thinking that's what I want to achieve or is it just a personal grind?
You know, I've learned not to compare myself to anybody. I think that could be a dangerous thing to do. It could be a poison. There always will be much more successful people than I am.
Yeah.
So I don't ever think of myself as I need to beat somebody out. It's really, I'm always thinking about the future. Like, okay, how am I going to support my family? What's going to happen in 10, 20 years? And the scary part is, I don't know. Like, I'm starting a new enterprise now. Will it be successful? I'm always asking myself, I'm up in the middle of the night, is it going to make it? Am I doing the right thing? I guess it's what most entrepreneurs may struggle with.
So let's launch into that a little bit. So you launched a business, you sold it to an industry giant, and then you started a new business, and you just mentioned that you're starting a new enterprise. Can you walk us through just high level your journey so that the listeners have some context for kind of who you are and your story?
Sure. So I started a digital agency. It's called Blue Fountain Media. It took me over 10 years to get that company to a stable place. After 13 years in business, I was able to sell it to a global Fortune 500 company. And it's been left in very good hands, great team there. I worked so hard to get that company to a great place. And I left because I always wanted to start a product type website, something that's different from a service-based company. And part of it is an itch that I'm like, I got to try to do this. And what's funny is I had a vision for what this new venture was going to be. And within 3 months of launching it, I realized that my vision was not going to make it. And I either had to stop and say, you know what, shut it down. I know it's not going to go in the right direction. It's not working out. Or change the business plan. And I decided to change the business plan, something that made more sense to me. And I got to tell you, when it hit home that when I realized it wasn't going to make it, it was very heartbreaking because it's not like I just worked on it for 3 months. I worked on it for a year. and I put money into it.
Will you share with us, just so we understand, because I've got so many questions spinning in my head, but on that particularly what you're talking about, because I think for launch readers out there listening, it's such a powerful point around kind of what you think you're going to do, and then when the rubber meets the road and your plan meets reality, things often shift. Can you share with us that original vision versus how you had to shift that vision? And I sure. really actually want to dig into that one point in time too, when you realized, shit, this isn't going to work, because I've been there multiple times now, and I do, it's that you realize your baby's ugly and you're like, oh no.
Yeah. What happened was, I wanted to build a digital destination for designers that would serve as an inspiration for them. And so I built this site called Design Rush. And Design Rush had like the best designs, where it could filter by best designs by industries in print and web. It had articles for designers, and you had tools and resources for them. And the SEO was going to take a long time pickup, so I did some minor marketing, put some test marketing, about $1,000 a month, to see what would happen. And it wasn't sticky. My demographic kept criticizing the site a lot, and then it's not, if you're inside your site prettier, one of the media, they were saying the content lighter, your content's too business tone like. And you have to admit, this is my audience, so I can't fight them what they say. I gotta say, you know what, you're right.
Right.
And it wasn't until I went away for 2 days to Florida, to see if I want to live there from New York. And while I was in Florida and I was away from New York, I realized it just hit me. I woke up in the night and I said, you know what? This is not working. Because while I'm in New York and I'm working on this project, I'm thinking about the nitty gritty. I'm in the weeds. I'm like, we got to fix this. We got to do that. Leaving New York, going to a different place away from it all, made me take a step back and look at the big picture. And I looked at my Google Analytics and I said, who am I fooling? I'm like, this is not going anywhere. And it's just going to be throwing a lot more money at it. And people don't, the feedback I'm getting is telling me, you need to make a lot of changes. And even then it probably could fail. So I decided, well, you know what? I think it has potential. I think there's something I could do with this. But I'm obviously going after the wrong demographic, and I have the wrong solution here. And I decided to change it around. I said, you know what I'm good at? I understand the agency space really well. I was successful in that space. I understand businesses really well, what they're looking for. I said, I'm going to create a platform where I could marry the two, where when a business wants to hire an agency, I'll give them a marketplace so they could post a project and have agencies not bid, because bid is the wrong word, but provide proposals. They could compare not just price, because bidding means price, but they could compare talent and qualifications, expertise, all that great stuff. So now I'm building a marketplace, and I've been getting a much better feedback on this, and it's an arena that I understand a lot better. But my first vision that I was in love with, that, you put your time into it, and you kind of sell yourself on going with it, it just hit me like a brick wall that this is, you know what, everyone's telling you, your client, your audience is telling you, this is not what we want, and the numbers are telling you this is not going in the right direction. And it was heartbreaking to come to that realization. It wasn't easy.
Yeah, it isn't, and I appreciate you sharing that. And I think that what you said, I just wrote it down, that you can't fight your audience, is such an important mindset, because you're right. They told you what wasn't working and why and what to do with it. But interestingly, kind of you had this other layer too, right, of getting out of your day-to-day to kind of see the bigger picture again, about leaving New York to go to Florida for a little while. Just sometimes you got to break away from the weeds to even see what's going wrong, even when it's right in front of your face, don't you think?
Absolutely. I mean, being in New York, being at the work, I had a list of tasks I wanted to get through, and I had all these little, and I was like, maybe if I do this, it will change things. Maybe if I do this one thing, the numbers will improve and people will like it. And you realize when you take a step back away from it and just put away, shut down your emails, get away from your task, just have a clear mind and just go for a walk, it'll dawn on you that, hey, is this working? Is the big picture working here or not?
Do you think that you would have gotten to that successful place without that initial failure?
Well, Design Rush still has not made it. So I'm right now in the midst of building the marketplace.
But the feedback is good, right? Like, you know you're on to something better than you were before.
Yes, and based on the feedback I'm getting. But I will tell you, one thing to share with the audience is do a test marketing program, a pilot program, and see what kind of results you get. So when I launch a marketplace, I'm going to do a 2 or 3 month test. Now, I expect good numbers from those. But if the numbers are not good, I have to decide, well, is what I have really, does it solve the problem that people have, or people not care about it and I should rethink it? But doing a test marketing pilot program is very important. And don't come out with a website when you're working on one with all the bells and whistles. Get out there and start marketing it. Then that will tell you what to do with it.
So it sounds like one of the lessons you learned along the way, which I couldn't agree with more, is about piloting and testing and tweaking and not kind of going from conference room to full launch right away. What are other kind of maybe some of the more surprising lessons that you learned along the way about business that, you know, looking back, maybe nobody could have prepared you for?
Well, one thing I've learned the past few years, and this is on a positive note, is that it's possible to have a virtual team and have a effective workflow. And in fact, I prefer it now.
How
Whereas
come?
Before, I thought you have to have everybody in the office and face-to-face meetings. The problem when you're working together could be very intrusive. People just walk up to you. I do prefer having remote office remote work locations, like work from home or from whatever space you prefer.
Do you find that you get more and I don't know if better is the right word, but better quality, I guess, work done that way? I'm curious about it because, you know, there's so much debate about, well, can you really collaborate and innovate if people aren't in the same place? So how do you so I get that you have more focus, but how do you overcome those other hurdles to make sure that, you know, you're not just a bunch of virtual people checking off boxes?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point you bring up, and there are pros and cons to everything. So being in the same office, getting together and having a meeting to brainstorm something is a positive. But we are doing that now. We have people around the world, have team members around the world, and we had a call this past Saturday morning, a two-hour call. We use GoToMeeting to share screens, and we had people calling in, and we had people taking turns drawing like they would draw on a whiteboard, on an office. And it's honestly great. It's really good. Now, if you have to have an in-person meeting, we could all get together in a location. But I tell you, having an office is a headache. I had an office in New York City. I miss selling my company. I miss the people at the company. I do not miss having an office. That had a tremendous, not just expense and overhead, but problems. AC didn't work. You had clients coming in. I mean, just so many, one issue after another. Your rents kept going up.
It's funny. I'm only laughing because we office out of a WeWork. And one of the things I love is I'm usually here by myself. I've got 6 people on the team. A couple of them are local, but I don't need to see them every day. So they typically work from their office, their homes. But I love it here because I love the energy, yet I love that I don't have to interact with anyone. And I kind of like that combination of like the vibe and the energy, but I don't really actually want to deal with anybody.
I mean, look, when I was in the office, my door was like a turnstile. People just kept walking in. If you could say, please do not disturb, they'll still walk in.
Yeah.
And, you know, you never want to be mean or rude to somebody. You know, you always want to make people feel welcome when they come see you. We never want to turn and say, don't you see that sign? Don't disturb. But you only want to show support of your team. But the truth is, it is so distracting. It is so distracting. And the other thing I learned when I had an office is there were 2 people sitting right next to each other and they'd be Skyping each other.
So why not just do it over Skype anyway?
Yeah.
So funny.
And people always ask me, can I work from home? So I do enjoy working from home. And, you know, the world is becoming a smaller place. And I think businesses are beginning to realize that we can work with people on a, they don't have to be full time. They don't have to be on premise. You know, you don't have to see somebody face to face, etc. When I first started in this industry, it wasn't like that.
It's interesting. You know, we have a lot of large clients too, big, you know, global consumer packaged goods and restaurants, others. But I'm finding even with them, they're often not in the same place. So there might be core teams that are together, but the teams that are doing the work together tend to be virtual. And I do think that, to your point, I do think there's a shift in how we think about it. And I kind of like your perspective, though, of like, hey, it's actually a really good thing. So how do we leverage this, the fact that we're not together, as opposed to think of it as all the reasons why we're not, which is, I think, the first thing that people come up with, and that you still can innovate and collaborate and kind of come up with those big ideas together, but not have to be physically in the same place.
Yeah. And, you know, we do have team members in some locations. For example, there's three team members in Brooklyn, New York. They can get together once a week and collaborate if they need to. So you have that nice face-to-face. Now, look, working from home, you need to hire people that are very organized, self-motivated, et cetera.
So
and
true.
It's not for every business.
No, it is not. Yeah. Neither is being an entrepreneur, to be honest, because you have to have those things in, like, you know, spades. I want to talk a little bit about you. I've heard you talk about being a change agent. And I think it's one of those phrases that a lot of us use, but we think of differently. So before I dig into it a little bit, tell me a little bit about your definition about being a change agent so that we're all on the same page first.
The way I would explain it to somebody is an agent that comes in that helps you kind of review and strategize, improve, define your goals for your business operations. I focus on business development, so how companies want to generate more leads, more sales, etc. But it could be someone involved in how the a certain aspect of a company can be improved.
So if I hear you right, are you saying that a change agent is someone, regardless of what department or role, they're coming in and they're looking at all the pieces of the puzzle and saying, all right, what do we do next?
What can be improved in either a streamlined way, like to make it more efficient, or to make it more effective?
That's interesting. I hear a lot of people talk about the phrase change agent, like it's someone who makes change happen. And I guess that's kind of what you're saying, but I like your definition better, only because I think that having to constantly be a change agent is actually exhausting, in the sense of, like, I have to come in and constantly ignite new change. When, if you ask me, if you just rearrange the puzzle pieces in front of you, you can make change happen pretty easily.
Right. And change is such a broad word, you know, broad definition. Like, yeah, you could define anything as change. But when I go in, I focus on a certain niche and what I understand well.
And that's improving, is what you're saying. How do we
improve? Yeah, so I'm looking at a lot of companies, you know, they need to, especially in the digital space, and you're well aware of this. You need to be on the cutting edge. If you're not, you lose out to the competition. And not only the company, means he's got to trickle down to all the departments, and they got to work collaboratively together.
What do you see as the biggest hurdle standing between you as the change agent and then bringing that lasting change to the business?
Implementation. A lot of businesses, when you're there telling them what to do, they're going yes with their heads.
Right.
But to implement it, it takes effort, it takes time, it takes a big push from the executives all the way down. You got to see it through.
So how do you overcome that? Because is that an issue of buy-in on the front end, or is that just an issue of once you leave, the person who's been kind of pushing that change, the champion goes?
You know, you push the change. Well, on some cases, what you could do is, first of all, make people make sure that people in various departments understand it. Now, this is going to sound silly, but I recommend that people, you first of all make it very simple. You give a presentation, you give them documents to read, but then you give them a questionnaire, almost like a quiz, to make sure they understand it. Then you put a process in place to have the managers make sure that they're following through and they're providing some kind of proof that this is being implemented. You know, if you're talking about salespeople are probably the most disorganized team members in any company. You know, they go out there and they'll do what they got to do to make the sale. And sometimes they don't follow through on a process. And so if a company is rolling out a new feature or changing how they sell something, it's hard to get some salespeople who've been used to doing some things change how they pitch now. So you're breaking habits sometimes, and that's very hard to do. And you're trying to install a new process, and sometimes people are not process-oriented. So you got to put things in there that ensure, that provide evidence that, A, they understand it, and B, they're executing it.
How long do you think it takes for that process? And actually, let me ask that question a different way. Can you walk us through a case study, either with one of your clients or someone that you know that's done it well? Because I'd love to, for the listeners out there, to understand kind of that process that it goes through and how that really shows up. Because I think your point about we're asking people to break habits and create new ones is really important and much easier said than done.
Yeah, I'll use my own previous company as an example. I don't want to talk about any clients, but you know, like any company, we had a sales process. There were steps involved. So when a client calls you, you gather certain information and you relay to the client certain messages. And then afterwards, there's a certain follow-up procedure. What do you follow up? And then there were certain procedures to go through and make a proposal, because in an agency, usually you have more than one person making a proposal. So when we changed some of the processes, we created a checklist that the salesperson would do each time for each step. And I'll be honest with you, it wasn't a big hit in the company. People didn't like it, but guess what? It was very effective. Because that checklist was not the first thing we did. That came out after 2 months of frustration, seeing, okay, they're not following you. They're not doing it. I'll tell you a quick little story. When I was in college, I got a job at the Wiz. If you remember the electronics store of the Wiz?
Oh, my gosh. Yes, because I'm 45. Of course I do.
You're right. I went to NYU, and they had a location in the Village.
Yeah.
And they sent me for 2 weeks of training. And this guy came. He was amazing. And I learned a lot from this guy, and he said, if you do everything I tell you, you will have a very high closing rate. He said, but you're going to leave here, and you're not going to do it. So the first month I left after training, I did everything I was taught, and there were a lot of processes and points to go through, and I had an amazing closing rate. I noticed nobody else on the floor was doing it. And people would just shrug it off. I was like, hey, why didn't you tell them about this? Or why didn't you do that? They would just shrug it off. Guess what? After a few months, because my fellow teammates were not doing it, and because nobody was enforcing it on me, and because it was easier not to do it, I stopped doing it. And my closing
Even though
rates
it worked.
Went down.
Yeah.
Yeah. So if you have a process, make sure it's documented, make sure that it's enforced. And you have to make sure of this every week. Like on Design Rush, we have a process for every article we write in our trends section. We make sure that there's a checklist to fill out. Like, is the H2 optimized? Is the keyword front loaded in the H2? Are there at least 3,000 words? Do the images show value to what is being described? We have about a 25-point checklist. That the editor goes through and makes sure every article follows.
It sounds like, too, though, if I hear you right, Gabe, that the other part of that is you as the leader of this change, this new process, this new feature, this new habit, whatever it is, needs to commit to not just the training of it, but that constant reinforcement of it, because you do need to give people time to actually implement it, but also you need to hold people accountable for doing it. And to your story, which is so great, right, even though it worked and did better, you still stopped doing it because nobody was forcing you to do it, which sounds horrible,
yeah.
Right? I have to force you to do something that's better for you. But that is kind of the truth, right? You as the leader have to really decide that, okay, we're doing this and I'm going to commit the time and energy to reinforce.
Yeah, you know, enforcing it takes time and energy, and it's human nature to kind of be lazy about things.
Yeah,
it takes
sure.
a lot more energy to follow a process. Now, look, here's the one thing. You don't want to make the process ridiculous where it's just like, oh, my God, I'm never going to get through this. Or to do something simple takes forever. So I mentioned a 25-point checklist for my editor. It takes her 10 minutes to go through it, and we're only posting now one good article per day, high-quality article per day. So it's very feasible. But if I was going to post 50 articles a day, I would need a separate team to do that. It wouldn't be up to one person. So you have to make sure that you don't give them a book. Yeah. I once had someone and they gave me a book and they go, here's all our processes. And I'm like, I would never read this. Never mind, follow it.
Right.
It's got to fit on one page. And that's the key. And it needs a constant enforcement. Enforcement means management needs to review it with their team at least once a week. Review the best practices.
Do you think that this is why companies, you know, claim to really embrace change and want it, but tend to resist it when it happens? Is it kind of what we're just talking about, or is there something else?
Yeah, so it's one reason. It's one reason. It's just, and look, the bigger the organization, the harder it is to make changes. And the people know, and they know the need for it. They want it, but it's just more difficult to do it. So it's got to be something that they really want, the management really wants, and they're willing to commit to it. It's like going to the gym. We all know we should do it.
And maybe we go Monday.
Yeah, we try. You know, we give it a shot. But it's got to become part of a routine. It can't just be once.
You know, it's funny that you mentioned that, and then I have a question for you. I go to a 5 a.m. class, and it took me – yeah, so I'm up at 4 because I need a little bit of coffee first. 4 days a week. They don't have the class on Thursdays. But it – you know, people say to me, oh my God, that's such commitment, such willpower. But the truth is, it took me about 9 months to truly make that part of my routine. I did not suddenly one day go, I'm getting up at 4 a.m. and from here on out, I'm committed. It was a struggle and I had to keep at it. And it really wasn't until 9 months that it truly became my routine and my habit.
Yeah, two things. One, it takes a lot of effort. But two, people have to see the benefits of it. So if you're creating a process and people are not seeing if I'm talking to them about improving their business development process, but it's not happening, the salespeople are saying, look, I'm not getting more sales as a result, then they're going to stop following it. Like if you go to a gym for months and months and you're like, I'm not seeing any results, why should I go?
Yeah.
But the reason why you see people in the gym each morning is probably because they're seeing results. So there's got to – nothing is as effective as some kind of positive reinforcement.
So here – this is going to sound like a really obvious question, but I don't want to be assumptive. Why do you think it's so much harder for large companies? Is it just a lack of being nimble or the sheer size of people? Like, why? I always wonder, like, why? Why does it have to be so hard?
You know, not only is it hard, but to make change is so expensive. I mean, things that I see small companies could do on a dime, it takes a large company a small fortune to make. It's harder to implement changes the more there is, the more people and the more layers, the more departments. It's just more complex. And companies need to make themselves more agile. Like Google is one of the few companies out there that from the very beginning they made themselves different in their structure and their departments and the flow. So, but you got to make – you have to embrace the change because everyone's scratching their head saying, what happened with Sony who made the Walkman in the 80s?
Right.
It was the biggest thing ever. How did they miss the boat on iPad or iPod?
Right.
I mean, I'm sure there were people at Sony that had thought of the iPod.
For sure. Now, they had the licenses to all the music too at that time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was the iPod is a natural successor to the Walkman. I mean, it's just a no-brainer. And I'm sure people at Sony had that idea. Why weren't they able to get it out there? Can it be that, you know, companies, look, they're very bureaucratic. Sometimes they're too structured. So I've seen it where they know they need something. They try to pitch it, but it's not in the budget forecast. It wasn't thought of. They got to wait a year for it to come out. And you know what? A lot of great people get discouraged and they leave those companies and they go work for startups.
Yeah. Yeah, I think there's an interesting that you mentioned that. It's a little bit of a side note, but there is an unfortunate brain drain that happens with innovators at large companies because I think they continually get shut down. So then they go to the more innovative companies where they can play a little bit more.
Yeah.
What do you think, since we're talking about large companies, what do you see as the next big game changer coming to those corporations, the big companies that they're either unaware of or not prepared for?
I think, we've gone through a big change in the past 10 years. It was all about what the companies were feeding us. And now it's about what we as consumers want.
Yeah.
So it used to be, you know, when I was a kid, there were three stations on TV. ABC, CBS, NBC. That was, and then later on, they added a few more stations. But that was it, you know? So those three stations had all the control. What I watch, when I watch, they controlled what I saw. Today, you know, everybody's a broadcaster today. So today it's about what I want, when I want. And what companies need to understand is this mass advertising doesn't work anymore.
Can I share a quick story on that? Because I so appreciate what you're saying. I actually talk often about this in my keynotes when I do that. But I cut the cord on cable about, I don't know, 6 years ago now. So everything we do is on streaming. And I have two boys. They're 13 and 9. And we were up on vacation and the Airbnb we had cable. So they were inside watching, you know, Cartoon Network, of course, but commercials kept coming on. And I walk into the living room and my 9-year-old is on the chair with two fingers out trying to swipe at the television, trying to swipe the commercials away. And my other son, Liam, is looking at me. He's like, where's the remote? Like, where's the button on the remote for no television commercials? And I just about fell over laughing because, you know, the use of these mass media television commercials, not only was it not working, my kids were trying to get rid of them, but also 2 weeks later when I took Ari school shopping, we passed these shoes that were kept showing up on one of the commercials. They were like the ones that light up when you step on them. And he was so deeply offended by those commercials getting in the way of his show that he refused.
Oh, that's funny.
He refused to buy the shoes. Like, he wouldn't even look at them because I was like, oh my God, look at these shoes. They're so cool. You want to try them? And he was like, Mom, those are the ones from the commercials that got in the way of my show.
Yes.
And I was like, oh my God, that is not the response that those marketing geniuses were looking for.
Yeah.
But a great example of what you're saying, of that mass advertising doesn't work. And I think sometimes in times of change like now, people don't know what to do, so they do what they've always done. But it inversely affects what's happening to their brand. It's not just a like, well, that didn't work. It's a, now my son is not buying your shoes.
Yeah, you can't shove your product down someone's throat anymore. You can't just say, watch my product.
Yeah.
You know, stop what you're doing and do this, you know, or I don't care. It just doesn't work. I cut the cable too. I was paying $150.
I mean, why? You know?
for Time Warner. And I was paying $10 for Netflix and YouTube. I'm not paying anything for. I have some little girls at home, you know, I have some young daughters, and all they watch is either Netflix for kids or they watch the YouTube for kids. We didn't watch even 10 minutes of cable. I'm like, why do I have this?
Yeah. That's why we cut it too. And so my 9-year-old in particular, he will spend all day watching Minecraft YouTube videos, people who have taken screen videos of themselves playing Minecraft. And to him, that is the best entertainment possible. And it's just YouTube videos that people do of their screen captures. It's crazy.
By the way, the kids that make those Minecraft videos on YouTube, they're millionaires.
I know.
Those 20-year-old kids.
Well, my son started actually doing his own recordings. It's very funny to hear him walk through his own little creations. It's awesome. But so why aren't they prepared for it? And the reason I'm asking is it's in so many ways, it's so apparent today's world. I mean, all those people working in those companies are also consumers. They're also part of that new trend. So why can't they catch up to that? What's happening?
You know, the old saying goes, old habits are hard to break. And it's, first of all, nobody wants to get in trouble at their job for taking a risk.
Yeah.
That's number one. Number two, I could tell you that from working in an agency, you always have to be on the cutting edge. You always got to deliver. You got to be efficient with your hours. From what I've seen, a lot of corporations, you know, they don't have the same pressures and the same high expectations as when you're on the agency side. Agency side, that's why I think some of the sharpest minds or some of the most hardest workers, people that are very like multitasking, almost on the verge of ADD, they go and work for agencies. They want to be challenged. People that work for brands, I've worked at a brand before I went to agency world, and I was bored a lot of the times. I didn't feel like I was being challenged.
It's so I'm glad you mentioned that, but it's so fascinating to me that they haven't quite caught up. And I think your point, though, that I want to ask you further about is, you know, we say we want innovation and we say we want to take risks, you know, when it's the right thing to do, but they're not really allowed to do that at the end of the day, are they?
Or sometimes they're not given the proper motivation or the thumbs up to do so. Like, they really got to go out of their way sometimes, and they got to ruffle a few, you know, feathers. Just, they got to rock the boat to do it. And it takes a certain personality to be able to do that, because people do care about their job. They don't want to get into trouble. Look, someone told me once when I was starting my agency, you know, we're doing websites. They said, Gabe, that company will not hire you because – nobody will get fired for hiring IBM and paying them a fortune.
Yeah.
But if they hire your company and you're saying your company is more nimble and a fraction of the price of IBM, and for some reason it doesn't work out, they might get fired for it. That taught me a lot. I mean, when websites were relatively new, you know, we were like, hey, we would do a website for $20,000 that a huge enterprise like IBM might charge literally more than 20 times the amount and take much longer.
So to me, this goes back to what you were saying earlier, though, that I think that large companies tend to miss the mark on, and that is that testing and validating your ideas. Because I think you can launch innovation in a I want to say safe, because none of it's safe, but in a safer way, in a way that you test it small, and then at every step you get a little bigger and a little bigger. I think the reason that culture happens is because they go from the conference room and the presentation and the theory and the hypothetical numbers to a full-blown launch of whatever it is, whether that's a system, you know, process change or a customer-facing thing. And I think that's part of the challenge of why innovation and risk is so scary at large companies.
Yeah. I mean, look, somebody has to come up with the idea, right? And if it doesn't work out, guess who's where the finger's going to get pointed?
Right. The person who came up with the idea, which, yeah, you know, is why the whole, like, we love failure is such a load of BS most of the time.
Right.
Because nobody – It's rarely the case where I go into a client and say, God, you guys do – you are okay with failure. I see it. What's your 2-minute blueprint for getting a new business off the ground?
For getting a business off the ground, what I would suggest to anybody is focus on a niche and come up with a core offering, make a website, put a marketing budget, a pilot, you know, pilot program behind it, like you might want to do a 2 or 3 month marketing campaign, and don't — every bell and whistle that comes in your head, don't execute. First get feedback, see how that initial pilot goes, that test program, and do it that way. Not just to get something off the ground, but even when someone says, I want to redesign my site, I always tell them, well, don't just tear down your old site. Do it page by page.
Gradually. What do you gain by doing it page by page? That's an interesting way to think of it. Like taking something that exists and just over time evolving it versus changing it.
Yeah, you're evolving it, because a lot of companies may have nice sites. Their sites are not ugly. You know, their sites should be responsive. But certain pages perform better than other pages, and their sites may rank organically for SEO. So rather than taking down the whole site and redoing it and doing a 301 redirect, which may cause their SEO to go down, and then they'll freak out once that happens because they'll see their traffic dropping, it's best just to take a page, redo it, do an A-B test on it, see if it performs better, and then learn from that and do the next page. But that way, a site is not a brochure. It's something that should always be evolving. You never stop redesigning your site. You should always be in the process of improving it, because a good site will be your best salesperson.
I will tell you, we're in the process right now of redoing our site. So I'm going to take that advice to my tech team and my web team. But the website is a living, breathing thing, I think. And the thing I learned a long time ago, which you obviously knew way ahead of me, is that it's not a point in time exercise. You don't just throw up a website and then you're done, right? And 2 years later, maybe you go back to it. You constantly have to look at it. But I actually think that your advice is really great for any idea that you have about, you know, getting feedback, tweaking it slowly, changing little things versus kind of doing this 180 every couple of months in the hopes that one of the changes that you made works.
Right. And, you know, the first thing I always tell people, I say, first, make sure your site's responsive. Then if it's responsive, put yourself in your customer's shoes, go on your mobile site and ask yourself, okay, I'm looking at it now. Is the messaging clear? Are the buttons clear? Can I click on the, you know, is there navigation? I mean, how is it? How is the usability of the site on a mobile phone? The reason why I emphasize that is everybody's traffic between 20 to 70% comes from mobile. And it's very important that mobile user experience is good and that your site loads fast. That's another thing. If you don't have a fast loading site, that's the first thing I recommend to people. Make sure you it loads. You get an A rating on Google Page Speeds. And Google Page Speed Optimizer will actually tell you what to do to make it load faster too.
Yeah, I found out the hard way that was our big issue. Nothing was loading, so people were like, nah, moving on.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really...
So make sure it's responsive. Make sure it loads quickly. Those are two key. And then look at it. Just ask yourself. Another thing I find that a lot of times companies will have a sales team and they'll pitch the company, you know, they'll pitch it one way, but then you go to the site and the site says something totally different.
Yeah.
And I always tell them your website is your forefront salesperson. So I think it's important to have the salespeople do the messaging, I mean, with a copywriter, but they should decide what goes on the site because it should follow your sales methodology that you do offline.
That's interesting. So before I ask the last question, because I can't even believe we're out of time, but where can people go to learn and connect with you?
Oh, on Design Rush. Everything I'm saying, we have in articles on Design Rush, and you can even search for best website designs based on categories. So if you want to see a site to get inspiration from, you could do a search on Design Rush.
Awesome. All right, we'll put that link in the show notes. Last question for you. This has been so interesting. What's one piece of advice you have for launch readers out there that are looking to ignite change?
Be ready for an adventure.
I love that. That is a great way to end this interview. Gabe, thank you so much for coming by. I have taken copious notes about things to think about and do differently, especially I can't fight my audience. Remember that one. Sometimes it hurts.
It hurts. It does. And you know, when you get those messages, you're like, oh, yeah. Like, you want to prove them that they're wrong. And you're like, well, no, really. You know, they say the customer, I don't believe that online, when the customer comes to your site, that you can't, you know, you have to make sure that ultimately the customer's right. It's when I say when they come to your site, you can't fight them. They're right.
Yeah. That's, you know, I will tell you in all my years of business, and I used to do a lot of new product development, so a lot of market research. And I cannot tell you the number of, yes, but what they don't understand is happening in the back of the room while the customer's saying, and I'm thinking, well, you might be right, but it doesn't matter because they don't get it. So
exactly,
we're done here with this conversation because it doesn't matter what we think. Clearly, we have a problem in communicating that. So, Gabe, thank you so much.
Sure.
Okay, Launch Reader, before you go, I have an action step for you. Of course, I want you to think about the one habit that is holding you back. Could be many, but let's just pick one. Maybe it's a way of thinking. Maybe it's something that you do. Got it? Okay, now I want you to think about what you would rather be doing or thinking. The new habit that's going to make you all innovative-y and stuff. Now, here's where the rubber meets the road, like we talked about in this interview. I want you to create an action plan for reinforcement, like Gabe and I talked about. What are you going to do? What are you going to make part of your daily routine to make the shift happen and stick? Like my gym story about getting up at 4 a.m., it didn't happen overnight. It took months. Let's get into the habit, no pun intended, of building our routines to reinforce those shifts that we're trying to create. Go get it. Tamara, out.
Thanks for hanging out with us inside Launch Street. When you're ready to take your game to the next level, join the thousands of others that are upping their innovation edge on GoToLaunchStreet.com, the top online education resource and community platform for innovators looking to use innovation to get measurable results. GoToLaunchStreet.com.